right, it's the guitar riff. It's time, Matt. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the best Tuesday you've had all week. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and joining me, of course,
Matt Dixon.
And we know this. We're not buying timeshares.
No, we're not.
Right? Because investment, right? Mm-hmm. And that's probably in and of itself ends up as a YouTube short and then somebody going, why are you hating on timeshares? I'm like,
are you just like preparing yourself to speak to these guys? Because you know it's coming.
It was just a fun joke to get started with. Okay. Look, we've been thinking about a number of things on the show, or what to talk about today on the show, right? Mm-hmm. And Matt, I think one of my favorite ideas so far, you kind of brought it up, the idea of it's something we call factor-based investing, but you kind of phrase it in layman's terms, right?
Right.
You're like, well, what if we just talked about like asset classes and stuff? So
right.
Help me out here. What are you looking at?
You know, I think a lot of people get confused on the different types of asset classes that are out there. People want to know, what is a CD versus a bond? What's the real difference, right? Or, you know, that people hear talk about dividend stocks or growth stocks. And so there's, you know, kind of maybe not different asset classes, but different types of investments out there. And people don't really know the difference. And so I thought it might be a good idea to kind of run through what are the differences and kind of what defines them or what makes them different from each other.
Okay. So it's a little bit of a glossary kind of approach. I mean, you know, hey, let's give some definitions for what some of this stuff is. But it sounds like there's more to it.
Right. And you talked about maybe more factor-based investing. You want to kind of expand upon what that really means, because I think it's really highly, you know, tied together.
Yeah. So the idea that asset classes themselves are different ways that we categorize investments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we can talk a little bit about what that means and why it's relevant. It falls into the mind your shuns conversation we have a lot, which is diversification, allocation, and correlation.
But I think it gets a little deeper than that.
It does, because if you get into factor-based investing, it is the idea that there are some different, we'll call them factors, but there are different
things,
prototypical elements that are associated with an investment, right? It's a fancy way to
describe it. Can you give me an example of maybe one thing that...
Well, let's talk about really high level stuff. Okay. Investors hear all the time. Is a stock a growth stock or a value stock?
Okay.
Those are two different kinds of factors to consider. And then, is it a big company versus a small company? So size would be a factor. And so there are different numbers, different criteria of factor. And so I think that's what we want to look at, because this is something that comes up in lots of investment theory.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to bog our listeners down in theory. That's like kind of a yawn. I want it to be more like
practical.
Should we tie
it more to how do you look at that and say, this one's right for me, you know, or is it a combination of these, you know, maybe something that I should explore? Do you want to get into that route a little bit?
Yeah. Or let's talk maybe about how do these different factors sort of play with each other? Like, you know, how do they interact with each other? How do you maybe build a more effective investment strategy or build something that you're maybe getting? Let's talk efficiency from an investment standpoint, right? If I own two things and one goes up and one goes down, I may be diversified, but it may be counterproductive. So I don't really end up making a lot of progress, because when one is working, the other is not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we can, through better research, potentially, and I say potentially because, you know, we can't predict the future on this stuff, right? That's the age old, like, past performance doesn't predict the future. And that's true. But if we say that we've seen patterns, and if those patterns persist, then this would be a reasonable approach to investing. And that has sort of played out over time, is that trends tend to persist in the market. I mean, that, of course, the joke is that the trend persists until it doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, markets go up until they don't go up. Okay,
right.
Thank you. That's not, the question is, what changes the trend, right?
Right?
So I think we could look at factors that way.
Yeah. And one thing you just kind of talked about was, maybe I have one investment that's doing good, one that's not doing so well. Maybe that's okay too, because you might have an approach where you're maybe kind of short term in some of your investing, where you're like, well, you know, this portion maybe doesn't need to fluctuate a whole lot because I might need access to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe one of your other positions is dedicated to being a long term position, so you're okay with more fluctuation and you're okay with that position being down for a little bit. So maybe we talk about that too. It's okay to be in different types of, you know, asset classes, where you have different things in mind based on what type of investment you're holding.
Yeah. Yeah. I will take it a step further. I think it's hard if you're trying to invest with any reasonable amount of risk management, you're going to end up owning a mix of stuff.
Right.
Because, and that's something we should really frame up the discussion. You know, risk gets thrown around a lot, but in this case, I want to think of risk not like the risk of you getting in a car accident, right? I want to think about risk like volatility and the possibility of loss.
Okay.
Now, typically we don't think of, now the possibility of a permanent loss is real. Hey, I buy an investment and
it never comes back.
It like the company goes out of existence, right? And so that investment is gone. That is possible. But it's not necessarily the more typical thing that we see happen. But then again, it sort of depends on how you're going to analyze it, right? If you buy the individual positions, you actually have, like, so if you're a stock buyer as an investor, you go out and pick individual stocks and that's what you own, you have a different level of accountability than buying a mutual fund, right? Because now you have another layer of, let's call it diversification and insight. You've got somebody else making buy and sell decisions, and you're expecting that management team to sort of protect you from catastrophic loss and so forth. So, oh, that company's likely to go away. Well, we're going to, you know, discard that and replace it with something we think has better chance of success. And I think that's important as investors. Mm-hmm. Some people get it in their mind, like, I bought something and I'm never going to sell it, right? I'm like, now that I bought it, What if it's wrong? Just ride it in the dirt. You don't have to do that.
No.
Right? Investing is really interesting because, you know, even the world's most successful investors that are long-term buy and hold investors still sell stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Warren Buffett has sold stock, even stock that he likes,
or
come back to it later.
And he's sold stuff at a loss. Not everything he's touched
is true.
It's true.
So, Let's talk about factor-based investing, some of the things that contribute to what we would expect to generate return.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that. Then we'll talk about a little of, you know, how do you assemble investments into a package or a portfolio, if you will, and, you know, how might factors play into that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's relevant. You know what's not factors? Maybe we should talk about that.
Okay.
Some of the things that aren't necessarily factors. What do you think is what do you think where am I headed with this, right?
What's not a factor?
Yeah.
Man, I mean, I feel like that's a deep question. What is not a factor in buying a stock? Maybe just your personal opinion on it. I think that's probably the biggest one that I can think of. Someone's like, you know, I'm just going to buy it because I love it. I'm like, but does that make it an investment, or are you just like aligning with your value system?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can love it, but that doesn't mean you should invest in it.
True. Here's another one that's interesting. Tax, right? Tax kind of hits it regardless, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't care if it's a growth stock or a value stock or anything else.
Yeah.
Tax isn't a factor in investing. It's part of the backdrop.
That's a good one. I wouldn't have thought to have brought up on the show.
Yeah.
I really like that because I mean, I've heard some people that are like, I just want to, you know, jump into municipal bonds because there's some tax savings there. I'm like, but does that mean you're going to get the most return?
Yeah. So here's what's interesting, right? Taxes are a factor in whether or not an investment is appropriate for you, but it's not necessarily a factor of whether or not the investment's going to be successful.
Yes.
Unless the tax itself creates, the tax environment creates a competitive advantage for a company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's why I think it's kind of interesting. Like whether or not you have a profit in a position isn't actually the consideration for whether or not it's a good investment, right? Like your personal profit or loss.
That's interesting.
Doesn't change
Someone who is like, I'm up 150% on this position, it's a great investment. And it's like, well, it was.
Yeah, it has been, but yeah. It may not be today.
Yeah.
Because
things change.
Yeah.
Right? Like information is so fast. And so just because that did well for you then doesn't mean it's going to carry forward.
Right. And notice taxes is another one of those words that's conveniently ambiguous, right? Tax could mean, what do you mean, like the tax the company is subject to? Or you know, the investment? Like how
I think you're
or
talking
how
more
it's taxed?
Like your personal tax
yes,
situation.
Yes, like your tax circumstance doesn't actually change the investment. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it changes your behavior, right? Because you want to consider the tax ramifications and what it will do. but it's not a factor in how much that investment will perform. Right.
Like, here's a
you're unrelated to
this. This might be a decent example, right? So you buy a stock, and then the next day it jumps 45% in value. And you're like, well, if I sell it and I have short-term capital gains, well, that sucks. I'm going to pay a bunch in taxes. So it's not a good idea to sell because of the tax implication. And then, so you don't sell. And then the next day, it drops back to where it was. You had an opportunity to make a bunch of money, but you didn't do it because you were afraid of triggering taxes.
Yeah. Oh, and so let's be very clear. Taxes will often influence your decisions.
Right.
They're just not a factor in how you analyze
the position itself.
Typically. Not typically a factor. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we kind of set the table of understanding for our listeners. Like, hey, you're out there making decisions about, well, should I own this thing or not? Well, we're talking about factors, but your unique, your individual situation isn't necessarily considered in mm-hmm. the performance of the position, although it may impact your decision.
All right. I like it.
So we've got the table set. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. We will grab our first break. We will come back. We'll start unpacking the idea of, you know, like what are some specific factors and what do they mean? And I'm going to give you a hint. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you're an investor, how do these impact your expected rate of return?
Ooh.
Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where Matt and I are digging into factor-based investing.
Yeah, we're getting really deep into the investment world today.
Yeah. So remember, you can get caught up, too. Grab us on the podcast. Hit us up at littlejohnfs.com, and you can sign up and get the podcast of the True Wealth Show. So, Matt, let's start at the simple level. You said, well, what factors mm-hmm. do? And you know, we can pull research that I remember going to the dog and pony shows about this down in Santa Monica about what was called the three factor model.
Okay.
Three things. Now, what I say at the break, we want to talk about how investors calculate their expected rate of return.
Right? Okay.
Okay. So let me start with this first. Before we get into the factors, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. So, Matt, mm-hmm. how's your credit?
Good. We're in the 800 somewhere.
Great.
Somewhere.
Good job.
Yep.
Very important when you're a financial guy. You got to eat your own cooking. So good job. Of course, we're not advocating you go use credit. Okay. But we're going to use this as an illustration. Matt, if you had terrible credit and you went to buy a new car mm-hmm. and you needed to borrow money to do it, what happens?
They're going
to
charge me like 9-10% because they're like, we don't really trust you, dude.
Yeah. Probably at least maybe more.
They got to get paid for the risk.
Right. And what do you mean when you say they are getting paid for the risk?
Well, if I walk in there with a perfect credit score, they know the odds are pretty high that they're going to get paid back. So in order to be competitive with another bank, they're probably going to give me a really low rate, similar to the low rates the other banks, because they're not bearing a ton of risk. They're like, yeah, we're going to get paid back. Just the same as, you know, if you're going to go loan your money to a company that's always paid its customers back for borrowing the money, you're going to feel pretty good loaning them money. Whereas if you're going to a really sketchy business that's almost bankrupt, you're going to be like, man, if I'm going to loan you money, you better pay me back handsomely. So they're going to have to offer you more in order for you to loan them money than the company that has a perfect track record.
Okay. So, yes. In essence, what you're saying, if I'm summarizing, is, hey, if I look like a lousy risk, mm-hmm. then they don't have to compete for your business. You have to convince them.
Mm, exactly.
And so they're going to say, well, then you're going to have to pay us enough that it's worth taking that risk.
Right.
Okay. And the opposite was, hey, I have really good credit. You guys are going to have to compete for my business because you're pretty confident it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that is, in the investment world, the what you would expect influences the risk or the probability of a return. The more risk that you take, the more you expect to get a return.
Right.
Okay. So three original factors here, and then they've since sort of stacked on from there. Let's talk about the initial three. Market capitalization, size. Then we have value versus growth.
Mm-hmm.
We have size. We have book to market is what they call it. That's the value versus growth. Those are the big two. and I guess it's value, growth, and book to market. Okay. So
those are the three.
Those are the three. Now, before we explain why, let's talk about what each one is, right?
Okay.
Market capitalization. What am I talking about?
You're just talking about how big is the company. Like Apple, huge,
super, super big company.
Right. Yeah. Ross stores.
Not so big.
Not so big.
Yeah. Dutch Brothers. Small. Right. Getting, just getting started. Okay. So what about growth? What is typically defined in a growth company?
It's a company that I like to almost take it a step back, right? I think it's easier to explain first by kind of talking about like, what is a dividend company? A company that maybe pays a high dividend is taking its earnings and it's redistributing some of those earnings back into their investors. They're stable. They have a steady, you know, business platform. They're not really trying to necessarily expand at a really rapid rate, and they're paying you back as a shareholder. A growth company, on the other hand, they're not looking to necessarily pay a dividend or pay investors to buy the company, because you're, as an investor, you're banking on that company growing so rapidly that your return is in the share price.
Right. So the growth company is versus the dividend company, and it's not the same as value, just so we're clear, right?
No.
So a growth company is typically taking the profits, and rather than paying them out to shareholders in the form of a dividend,
back into
they're
the
reinvesting in anticipation of getting bigger.
Exactly.
Right. So they're trying to continue to grow the organization by reinvesting back into the organization. And so what they're looking for is an internal rate of return on the money being reinvested. So,
right.
Oh, if the company grows at 20%, then the money going back into the company has a 20% internal right. rate of return. So that's more attractive than if you put the money somewhere else.
I feel like you can often kind of establish that by looking at the PE ratio. Now that does, it's not a tell-all sign, right? But that's one way that I think you can kind of see, is it a growth company or not? Because oftentimes investors are willing to pay more for that $1 of earnings from the company, from a growth company versus a company that's maybe more dividend.
Yeah. And here's a sneaky one. If you're curious about the price to earnings compared to growth, there is a metric for that.
Isn't it the PEG?
The PEG ratio. Yes. Yeah. The PEG or the PEG ratio, price to earnings versus growth. And that growth is typically over a 5-year period.
Right.
So it's projected growth rate. And, oh, okay. Well, so you're willing to pay more for a company that's growing typically, right? Because that higher growth rate implies less risk.
What's weird to me is how some companies can get such a high PE ratio where you look at it and you're like, wait a minute, you know, Apple might have a PE ratio of what was it, 28 or 30, somewhere in that range. And then you get another company like, I think AMD is in the hundreds, right? And you're just like, man, if you're buying it, you're really expecting this company to have insane amounts of growth moving forward.
Right. Well, and you have to. I kind of just said something that was a little wrong. So I'm going to correct myself here when I said you'd expect the growth company to be lower risk. That's not actually what I mean. Because the growth company isn't paying you, you're taking on the risk that they have to grow, sustain the growth.
Right.
Which means higher risk, higher expected return.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The dividend company paying profits out should be, in theory, a lower risk, and you would have, therefore, a lower expected return. I know that that's kind of interesting, right? Like, whoops, I thought that would be a good investment. It's not about good or bad.
Right.
It's about
what are you targeting?
Risk premium.
Yeah.
What are you getting paid for the risk you're taking as an investor? So we've talked about big companies versus small companies now. Small companies, like big companies, are established, so they tend to be smaller risk.
Right.
Right. 10, not always. Okay. But that's largely the idea, is that bigger companies are safer than small companies, and companies paying dividends tend to be safer than companies that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then another factor is the book to market value. Okay. Think about this like a liquidation value, kind of like what would the company be worth if you just sold everything off? Okay. And if you have companies where their share price is trading below liquidation value versus above liquidation value, that's an indication of stress, right? Mm-hmm. The market sees something wrong with a company with a low book to market value,
right?
Therefore, higher risk. So where would you tilt as an investor if you wanted to maximize returns? to the higher risk spectrum of the market. So the classic case was like Warren Buffett's historically been a value investor.
Somebody find that though, because I think
Originally he was looking for companies that were low book to market. He wanted to be able to buy companies that were in or near bankruptcy and then reorganize them and then resell the assets at a premium to what he purchased them for.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until he started working with Charlie Munger that they started looking at the business model of the company and looking forward and saying, well, might growth be part of that equation as well? Right. So that did expand his
methodology. Warren Buffett was really kind of bottom feeding in a sense to start out before Charlie got involved.
Allegedly, I wasn't there, but this is the history as I understand it.
Yeah.
And so those were the initial three factors. But what does the market do?
It evolves. It changes.
Yes.
It throws you curveballs and you better be able to swing at some weird pitches.
Yeah. And so it adapts as it learns. Mm-hmm. Right. And I like to say the market abhors an exploit. What is that? I mean, that's a fancy way to say
that, you know, if there's something weird going on where a bunch of people are maybe making money in a weird way, everyone's going to learn that pretty quickly. And then that little glitch in the system will be eradicated.
Yeah, it's basically people will sniff it out and it will the loophole will get closed because the market, if it was an exploit, then there's a winner and a loser. And so the market seeks to eliminate those. It doesn't let you have a competitive advantage that lasts because everybody's seeking a competitive advantage. This, by the way, is also one of my favorite rationales to say anytime you see some ridiculous ad online that says, you know, this 19-year-old solved the market and figured out how to make $1.7 million last year, and you can do it too. Just click this link, right?
Right.
And you go, wait a second. You mean to tell me somebody found an exploit in the market and it worked so well that rather than exclusively use it for themselves, they're going to teach you so you can do it?
I think
that doesn't make any sense.
And I think there's an even more important red flag. If you're, you know, trying to find a financial advisor and they're just over there harping on returns, right? Like, oh, you know, we've got these superior returns because we've got something so special that no one else does. That might be a red flag for you because, like you just talked about, exploits can only last so long.
Yeah.
Or luck.
Well, I've seen some that are really extreme, right? Okay. And then you go and they say, look at the statement. It's like, okay, maybe it even happened that somebody kind of ran the gauntlet just right. They bought a series of penny stocks and they doubled down each time and they turned it into a bunch of money. But usually if you read in the fine print, it's like, well, this was a theoretical example or something like that.
And they didn't actually invest the money.
Right.
Yeah. We ran 1,000 different stock models and this one happened to
Maybe they did do penny stocks. They put $100 in each one and 98% of them failed and they are giving you the one that worked saying, look at this, look how smart we are. Because they're cherry picking the results. Remember this, right? If they're selling the results to you,
why wouldn't they just do it?
Yeah, why not just do it and make the money and not give away the exploit? They're making the money off of you, right? That's the issue here. And there are some places that are more legitimate than others where it's like, look, we're not promising astronomical returns. We have our methodology. It's largely worked.
Like maybe like a private hedge fund or something.
Yeah, you can subscribe to our newsletter and follow our picks and hopefully they work out, right? So that does exist. And most of the time that exists because they don't want or they can't get into the arena of directly offering the money.
Right.
Right. Let's say really weird one. I don't know that this is real or not, but if somebody doesn't want to be a financial advisor, right?
Okay.
They don't want the fiduciary obligations that come with it. And they don't want to be responsible for the actual money management. So what do? They sell the instructions for how to do it yourself. Right. Yeah. You buy the instructions from them. You do the implementation. The implementation is really up to you now. If you fail to execute properly, it's your problem, not theirs. They just gave you a set of instructions and it was operator error.
Hmm. Well, it's kind of like the Dave Ramsey thing in a way, right? Like he's just giving really super generic
advice. Yeah, it's a newsletter. It's effectively what it is, right? Like if this is just a newsletter subscription, it's not necessarily actionable data or there's no guarantees associated with it. So that's the issue is what are you buying?
Right.
But anyway, we kind of got off the reservation on it for a minute.
Because we were talking about factor-based investing.
Yeah. So let's come back to, we had our original three factors, but there are other factors to consider, aren't there?
There are.
Yeah. Which we need to go into, but it is time for us to take our next obscene profit. All right. That's a sign. Welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right, Matt.
Yes.
What is the Greek letter I am referring to in factor-based investing?
Is it beta?
It is beta. Ooh. Where's the bell?
Oh, we actually have one in here. I love it.
We did.
I feel like I just won something. How much did I win?
You get to keep your job.
Awesome. Okay. Well, so, that's
good. Best day for me ever. So you sent a great graphic that none of our audience can see because this is radio. But anyway, there are two big categories on this graphic. One is macroeconomic, one is style. This is a style factor. What are we talking about?
Beta is kind of a fancy way of saying, you know, how much movement are you getting in regards to volatility, I feel like. So, you know, if a stock is really volatile, you might see, you know, 40% swings, and that's kind of normal for its behavior. Whereas another stock might have, you know, 20% swings in its share price, and that's more normal for that stock. And when we look at, like, maybe say like the S&P 500, right? We're going to give that a beta of 1. And so if a stock has a beta of 0.5, you would expect about half the volatility compared to the overall stock market.
Yeah. For the stats nerds out there, what beta is a relative comparison against a benchmark.
Yep.
So the most common benchmark in the financial industry that I think is out there is the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. And so that being an all stock index, it's heavily biased to the largest companies in that index. And there's just over 500 stocks in the S&P 500. Different story for a different day, but that block is the benchmark. Mm-hmm. So if it goes up a dollar and something else has a beta of 1, it goes up a dollar, right? So it moves in lockstep, and it says we can explain the movement of the index, or we can correlate the index. We can't explain it. That's a different stat. It's different. It's not beta. That's our Sharpe ratio. Or rather, R squared. Sorry, so many nerdy things out there. But beta is just volatility, okay, relative to the index. A beta less than 1 has lower volatility. Beta higher than 1 has greater volatility. And that just means we expect the swings to be greater or less than its benchmark. Okay, so S&P is the benchmark. It doesn't have to be. Other indexes could be used as a benchmark, and you could have a beta to a different index. But commonly, it's the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, volatility is definitely a factor. I mean, and what do you figure you would expect to be compensated for as an investor?
You know, if you're going to have to have a bigger swing in things, you would hope for a bigger return.
Right. Higher risk, like higher volatility means higher risk. Remember, volatility is often a synonym for risk in the investment world.
I think that's a key point that a lot of people don't understand. Volatility, the swings of the up and down equal your risk.
Yeah. So
because if you can handle those, you're probably a higher risk investor.
And the reason you'd be willing to handle them is because you would expect a greater return, right? Mm-hmm. I'm taking greater risk. I expect greater return.
It's always funny, the person who wants all the return. I want, you know, 10% returns, but I don't really want to take any risk. And you're like,
it's a nice sound. I like unicorns too.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly right.
They're the best. So I just can't seem to find them. And it's always the give and take of investing is that it's a risk and reward trade, right? You're going to blend the two together. So high risk, higher potential reward.
Yeah.
You know, low risk, lower potential reward, but lower risk of loss too.
Yes.
Right. So, you know.
So those are kind of your style factors.
Yeah. Well, and so in that list, what are some of the other style factors?
We talked about it earlier, value.
Right. Value. So
how do you want to break that down for our listeners?
Well, I use that book. So value is typically the book share versus the price of the market price of a stock.
Okay.
So like what's the book value or the book to market value? Is the ratio.
What about quality?
So quality is a tricky one because to me, quality is a little bit subjective.
Yeah,
it's subjective in nature. And so, but it's reasonable as a factor because this is why factors, it just depends on what you want to use. I mean, what researchers try to do is say, what are common factors that stocks all share and how might we find some common ground for the behavior and explain it for
research? Could you talk about quality in the sense of like the more than just like looking at numbers, like the intrinsic value of the brand itself, right? I mean, is that part of how you would assess quality since it's subjective in nature?
So it's hard to say. Let's think of quality as more like a SWOT analysis.
Okay.
Right? So you look at it and say, what are the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities,
okay, and threats? So you're looking and saying, hey, look, lots of earnings growth, lots of revenue growth.
You could say they like great management team, a lot of patent protections. Mm-hmm. You have regulatory hurdles that prevent competitors from being in the marketplace, right? Okay. So we would call that a regulatory moat. Then you have strength of brand, you have market penetration. Like there's lots of different ways to look at a company qualitatively. And some of that is going to be subjective in nature, mm-hmm. right? Is that a good metric or not? Right? Is a quality management team? You go, how do you know? Mm. Well, they seem cool. What does seem cool mean? Like, how do you measure that?
Yeah.
Like, well, everybody shows up to work on time and they all wear the same size shoe. I'm like, I don't know what that means.
And so there definitely is some personal bias. I mean, you just mentioned shoes. Like for me, I love Nike shoes. I've worn a lot of different types of shoes and I'm like, man, the quality of these shoes, I feel like is just higher than a lot of the other ones that I've worn.
Right. And well, so, interestingly enough, with a physical tangible product, there are some ways to measure quality, right?
Right.
Consumer Reports will do durability testing and they will, you know, simulate running a certain number of miles, mm-hmm. and they will measure things, or they will, you know, put it through the washing machine a number of times and see how it holds up. They'll just do, you know, weird stuff to see how durable something is.
Right.
And I said, well, here are our criteria for testing, and here's how the results fared.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a sense of how it was ranked that way. In a sense, you're trying to do that with a stock as well, or like any investment for that matter.
Yeah.
Is, hey, if I'm going to be doing the research, how will I define the terms? And how subjective or objective will that data be? So you're trying to make it more scientific and more objective,
right,
in order to produce a consistent result, right? Otherwise, you're just investing like, you know, Luke Skywalker, right? We're just going to use the force and hopefully it'll work out.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I think you broke that down really well.
So. Well, brilliant. So there are other factors at play too, though, right?
Mm-hmm. So we haven't even touched on like all the economic factors that are out there either.
The economic factors to me are some of the bigger ones, right? Before we go into those, let me just kind of give you a conceptually for all of you out there listening. It's like a framework to build off of, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I have a confession. My confession is I think all of these factors are novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that they're causal. What do I mean? Right.
Right. Like the stock doesn't necessarily move just based on the factors we're talking about.
Right.
Because we've seen it, right? Like, and I hate that we bring this one up all the time, but GameStop, that thing moved because of Reddit boards. It had nothing to do with, was the company earning money? Mm-hmm. It didn't have to do with the company's quality improved because they changed their CEO. It simply was, everyone got behind it. And it's not just GameStop, right? Like we've seen it happen with NVIDIA. Everyone thinks that NVIDIA is going to the moon because AI is the next big wave. And gosh darn it, NVIDIA's got all the chips and they're the ones that are behind it. So just buy NVIDIA and just close your eyes.
Well, and at the current pace of growth, NVIDIA is on pace. Like if we did this, if it maintained this growth pace for the next 5 years, it would be like, I don't know, 50% of the S&P 500 or something ridiculous.
Right.
The
pace.
Like by itself, insane. Right? Yeah. It will be like bigger than the other 500 companies combined. It's just staggering the growth rate, mm-hmm. for the stock and the earnings and whatnot. The question is it really sustainable? You know, can you really take a company that's now the third largest company by market cap on the planet and double it every year for the next 5 years?
Right.
Like it's just going to keep it. Yeah. Maybe, well, but it's like, it seems unlikely, right? So these weird factors are not
really
causal. Yeah. They are, but we use them as explanatory tools and to give us an indication of what may be continuing. What really causes the price of anything to change?
Just your buyers and sellers. If no one's willing to buy something, the price has got to come down until someone's willing to buy it.
Exactly. It's what's the motivation for the buyer and the seller. And so that is that basics of supply and demand,
mm-hmm.
right?
And I feel like a lot of the style factors that we talked on earlier in the show can be heavily, heavily influenced by your economic factors, right? Like we're witnessing it right now. The Fed has come out. They've messed with rates. It's been the largest like movement in rates that we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years. And so money lending has tightened way down to like some of the lowest levels we've seen. That plays a factor.
You're saying some of the lowest levels you've seen.
Yeah. I guess when you're
Matt's the young one in the studio. Yeah. Like I can remember money being a lot more expensive. Look, let's do this. I want to unpack in the last segment, let's unpack a little bit of the economic factor base in this decision, and then we'll try to bring it home. But we do have to take one last obscene profit.
Okay. Break.
Exactly.
We'll do it.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where Matt insists. I was like, well, I kind of, but no, I'm going to let him take the reins on this one. He's super stoked. Macroeconomic factors here. Yeah. And if you were in it, just to our listeners for a second, break it down and say, all right, remember everybody, if you're listening. So maybe you're an investor. You're trying to figure out what are the different things that you need to consider when you're buying and selling stuff. And you're going, I heard these guys on the radio talking about factors. And then somebody goes, blah, 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 blah. Macroeconomic factors, blah, 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 blah.
Are we going to consolidate this down into like one little blurb?
Well, are you? What exactly do we care about?
Well, we started talking about all the style factors and how they play a role. Then we transitioned over into, you know, a lot of those are affected by even greater, bigger things, more macroeconomic factors. And we started talking about it before the break. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you know, what does that really mean? And I think the biggest driving factor in all of this is cost of capital. So how easy or difficult is it to get access to money? And is that money cheap or is it expensive?
And that has been, say that again for our listeners, because I think it's so important if you consider the, like both the way the government behaves and the way the consumer behaves.
How cheap or easy is it to get access to money? And I'll even make it more simple than that. Imagine for a second, interest rates on a home mortgage go to 2%. What do you think is going to happen? Everyone who was wanting to buy a house and couldn't is going to buy a house because they're like, oh my gosh, the rates just magically went from 6-something to 2.
Yeah.
This is the time. Buy, buy, buy. And you see money come into the system, right? And you start seeing money change hands.
And what might happen to houses if mortgage rates fell to 2%?
The cost would go up and we would see inflation go because, even higher.
Because the supply, right? Remember, supply and demand. And what just went up? The supply of money increased, right? The access to money. So consumers can get more money to go buy the same number of houses.
Right, because under the hood of those macroeconomics, you've got credit, you've got liquidity, inflation, the, you know, growth. Like, all of that is wrapped up in it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what is driving all of those things?
Yeah, that is sort of the underlying elephant in the room. It's like, well, why does the government keep borrowing money? Well, you would borrow money at 1-2%.
Mm-hmm.
So the government's like, well, we can do it too.
Right.
And with rates going way up and everybody's correctly saying, you know what? The interest rate on my credit cards just got really expensive. Now it's hard to pay that credit card bill. And everybody's, you know, the government's saying the same thing, like, oh, it's just got real. I'm trying to finance our appetite at this price point. It's hard.
And that's why I think it's really important when you're analyzing stocks, for example, you know, in this environment, when the cost to borrow money has gone up, what companies have a bunch of free cash flow or free cash on the side where they can use that money to either reinvest in themselves or get themselves out of the pickle.
Right. And I will just mention, we're not saying that, you know, finding companies with free cash flow means that they're good.
No.
Right. This isn't a recommendation, but it is, I think, a very good observation when we consider what companies might be more attractive in this kind of environment.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you're a company right now and you've got a ton of debt and you're having to finance more debt and instead of it being at 2 or 3%, now you're financing it at 7 or 10%.
Right.
That cuts into your overall, you know, ability to generate revenue.
And it explains why recessions can be so dangerous. Mm-hmm. So if you already have debt and you're having to take on more debt that costs you more while simultaneously seeing revenue decline.
Ooh, that's right? A bad recipe.
That's a really bad cocktail, right? Yeah. This is the equivalent of, shoot, I've maxed out my credit cards, rates went up, and I can't get any overtime anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? Or I lose my job.
Right, because companies right? are having to downsize.
And yeah. well, I'm not talking about the company now. I'm talking about you as a yeah. person. It's like, if you borrowed a bunch of money and all of a sudden the price, like your minimum payments double.
Yeah.
And you lose your job, you're in trouble.
Absolutely.
Right? Like you're in big trouble if like your lifestyle is funded by putting more and more on credit cards
mm-hmm.
and you've maxed out the credit card. And in a sense, that's the question that our government is staring at. And that's the question a lot of bigger companies that have been growing a lot, but they've been doing it by financing and reinvesting, have to now contend with.
Do you think that might kind of explain why some of these really big tech companies have done well in the marketplace? I mean, they have a lot of cash.
Yeah. And I think it explains the difference between the really mega tech companies and the companies that have really strong cash flow
mm-hmm.
versus companies that do fine, but maybe they're consumer staples or they have a different product cycle where there's a line of credit that kind of manages the flow of inventory and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so those companies, the cost of capital affects margins.
Right.
Whereas companies that just have fairly high margin business, the cost of capital is less of an issue. You know, the bigger issue is that maybe the rate of growth slows because with interest rates, they're not able to arbitrage their growth rate as effectively against the cost of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But that's why I think really big, and if you're, you know, arbitrage just means you could borrow, you know, at one rate and then invest at a higher rate. So if you're a company, like
I
a
feel
growth
like
company,
banks are a good example of that.
That's,
right?
That's
like,
all banks do.
Like look at a bank. They're going to offer you maybe 1 or 2%, some of them on.
Well, right now 5 in a CD. But what are they going to loan the money out at? 7, 8, 10?
Yeah. Well, that's the crazy part. One of the local banks I looked at, they're 3 or 6 month CDs. They're like 2%. And I'm like,
But what does that tell you about that bank? They don't have a lot of pipeline of loans that they need to satisfy.
Yeah.
So they don't have to offer a higher rate to get capital in to lend it out.
Right.
So it means for whatever reason, they don't have a big capital demand at the bank right now.
Right. And so, and they're just making really good money on the ones that sign up for that, because if the free rate of returns at 5.
Yeah. Well, the question is how long do those stick around, right? Because the economy keeps rolling.
Right.
So.
Yeah. It's crazy.
So yeah, I think that's a really good way to sum up one of the biggies on the macroeconomic side. The cost of capital is a huge influencer. We've certainly, if you kind of use that as the backdrop for a lot of the behaviors of the market over the last 5 or 10 years, I think it's really interesting.
What if someone is like, wow, everything you said started click and I want to know, you know, maybe more about how do I, you know, invest my own personal money? What do they do?
Sure. Well, step one is, you know, start learning. I mean, if this is something where you say, I want to learn how to do this, keep listening to our show, go to our past podcast, mm-hmm. and start doing your homework. If it's something where you say, I just want to find somebody that considers this stuff for me, then I would say, hey, you can see us after class, right?
What is the after class phone number?
It's the equivalent of saying, if you would like to call our office just to talk and see if we could potentially help, we would be delighted. Our number is 541-375-0898.
Email at info@littlejohnfs.com.
Exactly. And so, and I think it's important to know, we're not going to charge or anything like that for an initial consult. We're here to help, right? Yep. So as I like to say, if you're not going to do it yourself, find help, find someone you like and trust. If you don't have that someone, give us a call. Again, 541-375-0898, but we're out of time for now. So until next time, thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM. 1240 KQEN.